From 7CTOs, my name is Etienne De Bruin, and you're listening to the CTO Podcast. Every week, I spend time with fascinating people that enrich the lives of chief technology officers around the world. From perfecting the basics of building technology organizations to inspiring our minds into shaping our future. As always, the CTO Podcast is brought to you by 7CTOs, helping CTOs become world-class leaders. Let's go. On today's show, we have Matt Van Italy, who is the founder and CEO of Seema. Seema builds software to help engineering leaders manage the use of Gen AI in the SDLC and tell the story of their code base to non-technical executives. This is a topic that is really close to my heart, as I'm constantly talking to founders who don't know what's going on with their code base. A fun fact is Matt and I are from the same era. Matt learned to code BASIC on a Commodore 64 with cassette tape memory. For my listeners who don't know what cassette tapes are, maybe you should just bounce to another show, another CTO show. I learned how to code in BASIC on an Atari 800XL, but definitely also with a cassette tape. So anyways, enjoy the show. Super fascinating. And I'll see you on the flip side. So Matt, what fascinates you, man?
So many things fascinate me. Pragmatism, helping improve teaching and learning at scale, treating code as data to study, thinking about building great teams, feedback. It's a pretty long list of things that fascinate me.
I love it. You mentioned pragmatism. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I did not study any philosophy in undergrad, but when I got to graduate school, I had the chance to become a generalist again and started studying philosophy, beginning with the history of treating the law. I have a law degree in graduate school, treating the law as a science. So how the law has progressed, when it does and doesn't actually happen for judges to take real world consequences into effect when they're making their decisions and whether they're conscious of that or not. And that revealed to me that there is, of course, more than one worldview. I know that seems really obvious, but I had been so baked in some core beliefs about pragmatism for myself, that the way to understand something is to look at its ends and consider if that's the best path, that actually wasn't always a given, that was a philosophical school, and which led me to the American school of late 1880s, I guess 1860s to 1900s, of the school of pragmatism, where this idea of thinking about the impact of actions, of thoughts, is one of several competing philosophies that people could adapt.
You're going to have to tell me more about 19th century philosophy of pragmatism.
What would you like to know?
Well, I think you gave a definition of it, where you consider the ends. Is it where you consider the ends and just work your way back?
That's how I think of it, yes.
Because be pragmatic is something that CTOs, technical people, we all sort of are, oh, I'm a very pragmatic person. But now you've got me doubting if I even know what we're saying.
Yeah. So I'm going to give you a non-answer to begin with. One of my favorite articles of all time, in this case, academic articles, but articles period, is a piece about competing canons of construction. We're going deep fast, but that's the kind of person you are. It's the kind of person I am. Canons are pieces of advice. Construction is how to understand something. And competing means the things are at odds. And with a very fancy title, Llewellyn from the 1920s, legal scholar. But it basically means very simple sounding aphorisms that when you say them absolutely make sense. The opposite aphorism also makes sense. And so it is not enough to make decisions based on whether or not what you're saying makes sense.
Wow.
because our human brain is built for sense making. I do have a real example, both from, I hope my children aren't listening, both from being a parent and also, so I'm a lawyer by training. I did small claims mediation where instead of talking to a judge, they would talk to me and I would do my best to help them come to a conclusion. Two parties would walk in the room, party A and party B, and I'd have them each talk. And based on the initial conversation, I had a point of view about what would most likely lead to a good resolution, meaning the two of them would agree. And sometimes I would say, all right, A went first, now and then B went. It's obviously fair to continue that process. So A, I'd like you to talk next and respond to B, and then B, you're going to go again. Vigorous nodding. Sometimes I would say, A, you went first, B went first. Obviously, to be fair, now B gets to talk first. So B, you go first, right? And A, B, and A, B, A both feel fair and tap into your smiling, right? They both tap into this sense of fairness and people don't even know it. And I got to experience that. I was literally reading that article and being in court and recognizing, I'm sure, at least informally mediated disputes where sometimes you want one person to talk before the other. And so we can't rely on common sense, air quotes. We can't rely on what we think is right, because if we are, there's just some huge assumptions underlying it. And it is not a coincidence that I am the son of a computer programmer and the son of a computer programmer turned mathematician that led me to empiricism of a very empirical parents, very logical focused. And I just think that that philosophy is more likely to bear fruit because the other philosophies, folks in the United States may be familiar with this idea of originalism, where you're trying to understand what people in the 18th century or 19th century thought and therefore trying to apply it. Anything but thinking about the outcomes and what is more likely to achieve the right outcome in that situation, I think we lose fidelity along the way and the accuracy and the quality of our decisions goes down. So I don't just believe in empiricism. I'm a salesperson for it. I get a 5% commission when people sign up for empiricism. They send me a check. It's really nice.
Do they send it to you in white envelopes?
Exactly.
So what you said is actually very, very interesting for me because I actually do help quite a few C-suites who are in a conundrum. And, you know, I just on Monday thought to myself, what this CTO is saying to me in a coaching session makes total sense to that person. They believe completely that they are making sense. And if you listen to the steps that they're taking to get to the conclusion that no one ever takes them seriously, or they want a larger R&D budget, but this is why the company's so for that person, the argument follows a logic that makes total sense. Then I go to the other coaching session, I talk to the product manager who doesn't get along with the CTO, and the product manager gives me an argument that makes absolute total sense to that person. And the conclusion I got to, and I really want to hear what you think about this, but because it's so interesting how, so for them, because it makes sense, they are correct. And what you said earlier was, no, the brain is just wired to make sense. And you could have the two, what did you call it? The two opposite truths?
Yeah, competing canons of construction, opposite truths.
Competing canons of construction.
How they are constructing a reality, how they're making sense of the world.
So now you have, at a CTO level, C-suite level, I've somehow gotten into the groove of working with co-founder conflict and all that. This case that I'm sort of working on right now is one of the most polarized, galvanized positions that I've seen, where you have a leadership team that can be so utterly convinced that they are the ones that are making sense and the other party is nonsensical. So when you're sitting at that table and you're doing the A, B, A, you know, what are you hearing from the situation I'm describing to you?
I'm going to answer it in three parts. I obviously don't know the situation, but you asked my opinion. Here I am. I'm going to do it. Part one is I would be super keen to have the parties involved build a logic model. And we'll talk about that in a second. Part two, after reviewing and discussing the logic model, it sounds like there is a larger it about the degree to which people trust each other and are open to new ideas. And then part three is what to do if that it really sticks around. So now I'm going to talk to you, also obviously get a huge commission from people going to Wikipedia and looking up logic models. So very simple. Anything, almost anything, not relationships, they're different. Anything in organizations can be summarized as follows. Resources, activities, outputs, and outcomes. Resources are what organizations have at their disposal. People's time, cash, vendors, stuff you can use. Activities are things you do. Outputs are things that happen as a result. And outputs can be an extremely long list if you want it to. Outcomes are things that happen as a result, but is an extremely short list of things that matter. And the art and science of logic models is being incredibly, incredibly hard on yourself of limiting the team, the group, whatever, the problem, on what is the outcomes. They can at most be three, and frequently they can be one, just one. And an example of an outcome is, in our world, is releasing a product that generates X amount of revenue. That is an example of an outcome. A consistent and predictable engineering process, or a consistent and predictable amount of engineering work being done, is an output. It's never, ever, ever the actual thing you want and need, but it could be helpful. It could be a quite important output, but it's not the thing itself. Code quality, non-functional requirements, a topic that is near and dear to my heart, is never an outcome. You really might need it, and depending on the situation, you need a certain level of it to be successful, but code quality is never, non-functional requirements is never an outcome. And so to help people understand themselves, and especially to help people understand each other in tough situations, I really like, all right, can we agree on the outcome? Can we separately write the small number of things that we really think we're trying to achieve? Can we understand those? Are they the same? What if we all wrote them separately? Because that could be helpful. Like, what actual thing are we trying to solve? And someone has to be a neutral arbiter of, okay, that's an outcome versus output. But basically, it's just a very small number of things that really matter the most. If that leads to conflict, that's good conflict to understand. Well, are we trying to solve different things? When you can resolve to get to the outcomes, in a confrontational situation, having people find a way to just be curious. You know, guys, we really are going to have judgment-free. All we're going to do right now is listen. We're all going to write a logic model for getting to the outcomes in mind. First, agree on the outcomes. Then we're going to each build logic models to get to those outcomes. And then we're going to present. And in the next 15 minutes or for today, all you're allowed to do is ask clarifying questions. I'm appointing myself. I'm appointing you. If I hear any question that's passive-aggressively a judgment, I'm going to stop you. Because just today, because the other part of our brains is we're way good at jumping into judging when sometimes we just need to listen. So we're just going to listen to each other about different logic models. And then in a separate conversation, if it's confrontational, it can be condensed if people are hearing each other, then how do we assess the likelihood of the resources driving the activities and the activities driving the outputs and the outputs driving the outcomes? That's part one. And part two, all kudos to Bezos. What happens if we're wrong, right? The door you can walk through versus the door you can't walk through. And all things equal, you should be doing things of doors that are reversible. You should be running experiments before you make conclusive results. So test as much as you can and do lower stakes things. And then see which path makes sense. And then keep track of it. Come back in 2 weeks. Come back in 4 weeks. Come back in 8 weeks. And compare your likelihoods to that answer. I love this. And any of you who are listening for larger organizations, one of the things I really, really like about this is actually making sure that every person, a logic model for the company or the organization, that every single person knows where they fit in as it relates. And there should be no one on the org chart that you can't figure out a way on how they're contributing an output that's driving an outcome. I'm sure you've heard this story, but it's so good. When John F. Kennedy visited NASA, when they were trying to, you know, the first set of space exploration, as you know, he ran into a janitor and the janitor said, "What do you do?" And he said, "I'm putting a man on the moon." That is a sign that he's figured out, you know, buy-in. He can see why clean floors make everything possible. So I like logic models for strategic decisions, but I also like it. You need to wake up. Your organization will be much more effective and the team will be so much happier. And it gets harder at larger organizations if everyone sees logically how their place fits.
And what I love about that is it gets you out of the forward thinking conclusions, like my steps make sense. It kind of picks the rat up by its tail or the mouse. And it's like, well, let's go to outcomes and let's see how your output is contributing to the outcomes that are presumably aligned with the business objectives.
Exactly. So that was a very long answer to part one. Again, generically, you have that conversation. Part two is, well, boy, we sure have a hard time listening to each other. What might the underlying causes of that, the five whys, like what's driving it? Is there something? And then step three, to the extent the organization is small or medium, the answer is either you solve that and you get on the same page, or some people have to go. Businesses move too fast. There is not time for fundamental worldview conflict if the team can't resolve. And so somebody, one way or the other, somebody has to exit if you can't figure out how to not have that repeat. There's just not enough time.
So in everything you just said, how does pragmatism show up?
Pragmatism is we care about outcomes. We are here for the outcome. And this is, I guess, a moral point as well. We are not here to serve ourselves as employees. We are here to serve the organization who is paying our salary. And the organization has some goals, and we are here to achieve them. And we owe it to the organization paying our salary to put our best efforts into achieving outcomes. And I guess pragmatism sneaks in a little bit too, that we can confuse doing things that feel right, doing things that kind of are nice vanity metrics, and it's very satisfying. It feels right because it's an achievement. But if you're really rigorous about the outcome, you may make a different decision, or you will make a different decision, or hold yourself to different standards.
What would you say is the opposite of pragmatism?
In the legal world, I do think the opposite is originalism, which is trying to understand. We have a sacred text. We have literally originalism in the United States. Study of constitutional law is think about what people meant and interpret the law today as if those people were around. That may sound absurd to your listeners, but that really is how judges, there is a school of thought where judges really believe they are doing that. And I believe that they believe they are doing that. Outside of the law, that's a super good question. I don't have a great answer. What comes to mind is a values-based approach. We do things that are in line with value X or value Y. And the reason I'm smiling as I say this is I also think it's incredibly important to have very intentional values, and that you should be evaluating your decisions against real, no BS values that everyone, including the CEO, has to measure. So I don't like the logic that led to the opposite of pragmatism is values, because I use logic models and we are militant about values fit. But I think instead of what does the data say, but I guess it's true, right? Instead of what did the data say, it's because X said so.
Yes, yes.
In our company at SEMA, we make product decisions based on, maybe this is the way that, it sounds fancy. I'm making it up as I go. We make product decisions based on what's most likely to help us achieve our business outcomes. So that's empiricism, pragmatism. But there are five core principles at SEMA because I, as the founder, said so. And I've worked in organizations where there was a collaborative value setting exercise that can work. We're early enough that I think the best, I've learned this the hard way, early stage companies should not have a collaborative set of values. They should have an incredibly strong set by somebody. And that, especially in a small or medium-sized organization, to have one person setting them and enforcing them is really, to set them, then everybody enforces them, is really important. And so I do think because I said so, because X said so, is the opposite of empiricism. But you, thanks to your great questions, have persuaded me sometimes there's a place for pragmatism or empiricism or logic models. And sometimes in the same organization, in the same day, there is a place for values. Values conflict could be a driver of people not listening to each other. And obviously, I don't know that situation, but I would be curious. At SEMA, one of our values is growth. A subset value is we always ask questions. And practically speaking, everyone is curious. And it would be rare, it would be super, super weird for people not to ask a bunch of questions about a different person's point of view. That's just not how we work. It would be against our values, unless we agreed. So I would be curious what the stated, and then more importantly, the unstated values are about how folks are operating, because the values are the real values, not whatever's on a pointing to an imaginary board as if it's on the wall, but like literally when you wake up, you work with some DNA, you have some core principles for how you behave. Unless you're explicit about them and bringing an organization together, they're likely not super aligned. That can be a huge source of conflict, because if you don't understand someone else's values and they're behaving differently in a way that you'd expect, you don't have trust. And if you don't have trust, it's toxic. You just start second guessing everything they're doing.
I think what's in this particular conversation, the opposite of pragmatic to me would be, the word that's coming up for me is scrutiny. I know it's not sort of syntactically the opposite, but I think that you can get so caught up in the why, and to your point about originalism, get to, well, why are we in this situation? In other words, trying to make sense of the situation that you're in, when really you could just let that go and keep focused on where it is that you have to go and have to be. And I feel like a pragmatic person is, okay, I know we're hurling through space and we've lost all power and all we have is duct tape and a screwdriver and some Skittles. I'm not going to sit here and try and ask, why am I in this situation? Whose fault was it? Why did this thing do that? I'm just going to be pragmatic about it. And then, dude, start cutting those Skittles in half. Let's get them rolled up in the duct tape and hammer them with the back of the screwdriver, because that is going to cause enough of a something, you know. So that's about as far as I can take that one.
I love it. And maybe I'll dumb it down for me. If pragmatism means look to the future and figure out what's going to get us to where we want to go, scrutiny is what got us here.
Yes.
Right. Looking backwards.
Looking the other way.
Looking the other way, right? Turn forward or turn backward. I think you are absolutely right. I do think that's the opposite.
And I think in the context of the problem I stated to you, I think that this executive is so hung up on how we got here that they just cannot build those logic models to get to the outcome. Wow. That was fascinating.
So fun. Great questions.
Are you ready to elevate your team's performance and your own career as CTO? Introducing the 7CTOs Growth Program. With 7CTOs, you'll join a supportive community of tech leaders dedicated to helping you reach new heights. Our group coaching program, led by experienced CTOs, focuses on the proven CTO levels framework. Assess your team, processes, and technology challenges with our easy-to-complete assessments, and then dive deep into monthly coaching calls where you'll get unstuck and gain insights on specific topics. Craft actionable plans tailored to your needs, guided by expert advice and playbooks designed to drive results. Plus, gain access to our exclusive CTO community for ongoing support and collaboration. Sign up now and start your group coaching adventure for only $300 per month or $3,000 per year. Your membership includes priority access to all 7CTOs events and activities. Don't miss out on the opportunity to join a global community of experienced CTOs, attend virtual events, and participate in confidential group coaching sessions. Visit 7ctos.com/growth and level up your leadership skills today. I do want to move from pragmatism to pivot tables, because they both start with a P. I've never been able to use pivot tables.
Do you want to use pivot tables?
What am I missing? I feel like the really smart people know how to make them. And I feel like people like me can't make them. I can never pick the right column. I can never satisfy whatever it is Excel or Google wants me to point to. And even when I see the results, I'm just like, man, is this what I wanted?
I remember where I was when I figured out Pivot Tables. That is a view into my psyche. I was in a hotel room. I was 22 years old. It was 10 o'clock at night. I was working at a consulting.
You're not kidding. You're not kidding. This is real.
Oh, I am not kidding. Oh, God, no. No, no. My family sometimes plays the game, what tattoo would you get if you had to get a tattoo? The order for me, I don't have any, is the American flag. I was a Boy Scout. The American flag, number one. Number two, a fleur-de-lis, which is a Boy Scout crest. It was very formative for me. Number three would be a pivot table, like in terms of things that are that important to me. So, listeners, if you more than once every 2 weeks get access to raw data or even slightly processed data that might help you make better decisions, I cannot stress enough, an genuine open hour of thoughtfulness, of taking another stab at it and doing it will freaking change your professional life. I'm happy to have like everyone get beers and pizza. We'll do it live together. I also get, every time someone makes a pivot table, I also get 5%. So we'd be truly happy. But the presupposition, and Google and Excel are about 10% different. If you get that raw data, if you can export from Jira, if you're doing work where you export from Jira, export from GitHub, obviously financials is world changing because it is such a fast question asking and question answering tool. You just need to, and there was this hump. I mean, I remember that time I was a young man of like, oh God, this is scary. It doesn't make sense. Oh, wow. Now I get it. And that is super cool. And I myself have taught it enough that an hour BYOB virtual would be thrilled. Anyone who wants, I can get you to it.
I think we're doing this. I think we're going to book a session. We're going to have some drinks and you're going to show us how to do pivot tables. Maybe I'll remember where I was and what happened when I took a sip of that IPA and I was like, oh my goodness, I get it.
I hope not for your sake. I hope your life has been more rich that when you're on your dying deathbed, pivot table learning is not one of them flashing before your eyes. Me, sadly, is not true. I'm very happy to do it. It's a super genuine offer. I only say things I mean. If you want to plan it, you or your listeners should suggest a couple questions that they think data they've used in their work could answer. And then I'll create some sanitized data samples and we'll use them on the call. Use them in the demo, whatever.
Brilliant. Thank you. Wow. Seema must be lucky to have you, man. Did you start at Seema?
I did start Seema. I did. 2017.
Does Seema stand for Software Engineers Mostly Anticipate?
That would be super interesting. It does not. It's a good guess. In 2015, I had another... this is my life. I had a clouds opening and the heavens parting and a moment of clarity in the summer of 2015. I had been working at one software company, and then I was starting at another software company, and I read another article, one of the seminal articles of my life. The company I was leaving, the CTO showed up to the executive team meeting and was talking just after the chief revenue officer was speaking. And the chief revenue officer pulled up Salesforce and was speaking from Salesforce. And the chief technology officer spoke from spreadsheets and hand waving. Oh, we're going to need to do a refactoring because if we don't go to service oriented, you're just going to have to take my word for it. That CTO was absolutely right. She's an amazing human being, huge fan. But it was freaking mind-blowing that, oh my God, Salesforce has a chief revenue officer tool of the roll-up that makes sense of all of the data, single pane of glass, and accessible to true to the salespeople, but also accessible to the tech, to the C-suite, to the board of directors. Do you mean to tell me that there is really not a CTO tool that rolls up everything and makes it accessible and understandable to the rest of the C-suite and the board? And the answer is no. And of course, sales is, I love sales, it's really important, but it's easier to understand than code. And once you know dollars, you can then move it to pounds. It's not that hard. If you know Java, you don't know that much about JavaScript, at least, you know, quantitatively. So it's a hard problem. So that was story one in 2015. Story two, I went to the next software company and another amazing CTO showed up to the leadership team meeting and said, we need to spend 60% of the engineering time on tech debt reduction. And it was bananas. And he was right. It was bananas. But that number just seemed so high. How did we get to this situation? What led to it? How is it that the new CTO had to make such a strong statement and put the brakes on that it thought, okay, we need executive insight into code, part one. Part two, we need to do that to avoid crazy outcomes. And I don't mean making a serious investment in tech debt reduction. I mean leading to a point where you're not making investments in tech debt reduction all along. The article, it sounds so cute, but I swear to God, it's true. Summer of 2015, Paul Ford, shout out, I love you, wrote a full issue length article for Bloomberg Business Week called What is Code? And it talked about the history of code and some of the trends and gender and code, all these things, but had a story all the way through that said, apocryphal, but obviously based on a real situation, the man in the taupe blazer shows up to your business and tells you you need to spend a large, undefined amount of money for an undefined period of time to fix your tech. And it was like, wow, I'm living these experiences personally, and then it's clearly real if Bloomberg Business Week is publishing. So I did what any totally bonkers person would do. In 2015, I turned on Google Scholar, and I was reading journal articles, academic published articles on automated ways of understanding code, automated ways of improving code. They weren't even publishing. There's a little bit of deep learning work, but it was mainly genetic algorithms at the time. I skim read 1,500 abstracts. I didn't read 1,500 papers. Read 500 papers, cold emailed 250 academics. And I thought, because I knew a little bit about tech transfer, the act of taking technology from a university or public institution and turning it and commercializing it, I knew that it's very hard to get right. The corollary of that is you should expect to find some gems available because it's so hard to do the process. So I did the opposite. I went to 250 professors and said, your IP looks interesting. Can I license it? 249 gave some version of no, but one said yes. And it was enough to kernel of the idea that's still in the product we do today. And incredibly thrilled that the University of Michigan is an owner of our business because of the great research that their faculty did. But why SEMA? What we have always wanted to tackle, our North Star is helping make code better. But it is not, we are not the creators. Obviously, we are creators ourselves of our own code, but we are supporting the creative work. We are supporting the craft of building code. And it most certainly is a craft, not an assembly line work. So in coming up with a name, thought about how do we pay homage to our supporting other creators? I did, again, what a totally bonkers person would do. I bought an encyclopedia of translators because human translators are not the original creators, but they're doing something very important to help support the people who originally wrote the work. And it would be cute if it was pragmatism and then pivot tables and we got to someone named P, but sadly that's not going to work. I got to someone whose name I believe in Sanskrit is pronounced Yoga Krema. Huge apologies for folks who do speak Sanskrit. Lokaksema. That is, of course, even I couldn't pronounce it. And so SEMA, short for Lokaksema, or sometimes called Lokaksema, he brought Buddhism from India to China. Boom. Incredibly bringing the incredible body of knowledge from one extraordinary culture to another.
Oh, okay.
Off to the races. SEMA.
Okay. Wow. Well, you have me hooked on the CTO dashboard. Sorry, so thank you. That's a great story.
Yeah, of course.
What are you calling are you calling it the CTO dashboard?
We have three products. One of them is called the CTO dashboard. So this, yes, you can call it the CTO dashboard.
So just in your experience, what are the top things that should be on that dashboard?
There's about 12 that we think are really important. The number one thing is developer retention. I love this because it's a little bit counterintuitive, but when folks listen to it, they understand it's right. Of course, that means what percentage of developers who worked on the code are still around. And we typically recommend weighting it towards the developers who've made a significant contribution to the code. Let's say it's top 20% of the commit, you know, people who've made a certain amount of commits or something like that. So, you know, volume of contribution works just fine. Having a low developer retention rate is problematic twofold. One is it's an anti-pattern that suggests that the place isn't a great place to work. Developers have a lot of choice and can choose with their feet. Shout out to Dave Mango for that observation. But second, and everyone on this call knows this, but Seema's job over the years, we've looked at 800 code bases for $1 trillion worth of software teams, and we explain that code to boards of directors and to CEOs and people who aren't as technical. We say, and I do think this is, it's both clever, but it's definitely true, having code but not having the coders is like having a half-written novel without the novelist. I don't care how good your documentation is. There is the logic and the context that is in developers' heads that if they are no longer there, the code isn't going to work. If too many of them leave, the code isn't going to work. So I said there were 12 factors. We spent a lot of time thinking about what those should be, and then certainly not at the beginning, but 6 years in, turned them into a 100-point scale. And again, it's easy to do the math, but more importantly, it would be really easy to get it wrong and really painful to get it wrong. And so we didn't build this math until we were sure. And so on this 100-point scale of 12 factors, developer retention is worth 25 points. 25 points. By contrast, the results of a pen test are worth 5 points. Not that they're not important, but if you have problems that were revealed with a pen test, go off and hire a cyber consultant or go get the work done. Like it's not going to make or break. It's developer retention is the biggest driver of an engineering team's success, outcomes, etc.
And that's very interesting. So two things. Is the developer retention a lagging indicator? So do you just literally, in your app, do you just like log when someone joined and when they left?
I think yes, but I'm open to hearing what you think the alternative is. Go ahead.
Well, I'd love to have a leading indicator.
Got it. In our line of work today, we don't have a leading indicator. I would say I do really like either NPS or some surveying. You mean a leading indicator of when developers are going to leave?
Yeah. The other day, I'm helping a company, and the other day, actually over the last couple of weeks, it's a fairly small team. Over the last couple of weeks, I've noticed one of the key developers sort of get more quiet. And so this person's contributions sort of started leaving the conversation. And he's not a very loquacious guy to start off with, but I, with my spidey sense, was thinking, okay, there's something up. And then I did a one-on-one with him, and he just sort of gently asked, hey, so who is prioritizing what as far as our product is going? Like, what are we going to work on? And this is also a company that spent a lot of time on getting rid of technical debt. So in a sort of anecdotal moment, I got a leading indicator that, I mean, it might just be like micro steps, but if his ship was sailing in my direction, like I just slight course change just because he was unclear on what is our vision for the product and where is this all going.
Yeah.
I don't know how a survey does this unless it's just like how happy are you at your, how informed do you feel about where the product is going? And maybe you ask 5 questions. I'm sure this exists. You ask 5 questions and somehow infer from that the person's most likely to stay or leave.
Yeah, I do also think there's software that does that. There's retrospective software where you can ask the same questions consistently after sprints and see how they change. But listeners, I cannot stress what a mini masterclass that just was. I hope you take this in the positive way that I'm saying it. What you just heard is a reason why high quality management, people management, needs to exist in the organization. the ability to detect subtle changes in interest, subtle changes in direction. Could you like look into the version control system and see if they've committed less? Sure, but that's not really the indicator. The indicator is watching them participate less or participate differently, and having people who like doing that is essential for the organization. And I am definitely not going on the show of the founder of the best framework about CTO management there is and telling it how it should be. But I guess I'd say, and that's obviously included in the 7 CTOs framework, is let's be sure to distinguish technical leadership from people leadership, from individual contributors, contributions, and technical leadership could be architecture and it could be future decisions on, you know, what to go with. And those are so fundamentally different interests that the highest performing organizations I see do a really good job of not associating status with any of those, but just being really good at matching people's interests to those parts, each of which is important. And organizations, not software organizations in particular, organizations conflate managing with status or managing with what you should do, and they don't distinguish people management versus technical management. And the closer you can match people's preferences to jobs, to their preferences, the more successful you're going to be. And you have to have that people management that Etienne just so masterfully demonstrated.
Thank you. And I think that's the part that probably lives outside of a system. Does generative AI give us some foot in the door here to read people's minds about whether they're staying or leaving?
There is software that does it. There is software that does sentiment analysis and activity analysis on what people are up to. It'd be crazy to say that it doesn't have its place, because there are some really well-established organizations that have produced it and that use it. I guess I'd say to every supervisor listening, what could you do to make yourself more open to hearing the truth qualitatively and directly before you go to a tool? Not that you shouldn't also use a tool, but how can you open yourself up to really being able to listen to what is being said and to what's not being said? I do believe in data, so I know it is possible to come to great conclusions. In a large enough organization, you can't do it fully, but are the people on your team really able to speak freely? And are you really able to hear them? And do they feel that their voice is heard? It is so powerful. And even the best people at it still need work and still fall short. And most of us are not the best at it. So just being able to really listen. We talked earlier in this about when there's a judgment mode and when there's a listening and inquiring mode, and just being able to try to flip that switch. Can I stop judging and make sure I'm listening? Because there, it is unlikely for small and medium-sized organizations that that kind of data will be as accurate or as actionable. That kind of like, hey, we're going to read everyone's emails in Slack and decide who's a flight risk, is going to be as actionable or productive as being the best listener you can and deputizing people to be confidential listeners who can then take feedback and then share it. I'm a really, really big believer in getting better and better and better at listening for exactly the things that Etienne was talking about.
Well, I think that is gold. And just like the word pragmatism, just like the word empathy, just like the word awareness, just like the word listening, such a simple word, easy to repeat, with the sense that you understand what is being meant by it. But when you really, that's so complex, so difficult to master, and you're most likely not even coming close to what you think you're doing when you say it. Oh, I'm really an empathic person. Like, okay, let's really unpack that. Oh, I'm a really good listener. It's like, okay, well, let's really unpack that. I love your emphasis on listening, the listening mode, especially when it comes to executives or conflict, where to each party, their logic and reasoning makes total sense. And it's so galvanized that they have stopped listening. And what I'm hearing you say is that in addition to the logic model, is that let me just stop talking for 10 seconds. Let me just listen with openness, like you said, openness, curiosity, a willingness to be wrong. And boy, that is just really hard for grown-ups to do sometimes.
Very well said. Wouldn't add anything to it.
Okay, Matt. Well, thanks for spending time with me. This is definitely not the last time.
Yeah. We're drinking and pivot tabling, which is going to be so freaking fun. I cannot wait.
Okay, brother.
Thank you so much for having
me.
If you're listening to this and you have not gotten into the 7 CTOs community, I cannot stress it enough. It's not hyperbole. The conference I've been to and when I've heard from the other conferences are so engaging and inspiring for people to talk. It's such a lonely job being an engineering leader, especially in smaller organizations. So that kind of connection is incredible. And just a small group, the 7 CTOs itself method is so powerful to have to talk through things because you can't talk about them at work, most of these topics. And then the leaders affiliated, such as Kathy and Scott and Eric, are such genuine, thoughtful human beings who are here to serve. Just an extraordinary. So thank you for listening. But if you haven't really dipped your toe in, I can't stress it enough.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. And again, thank you for partnering with us and being a friend. And some of your people, I think, are in the growth program. So that's beautiful.
They love it.
That's awesome.
The growth program, incredibly high ROI leadership training.
Okay, brother. Talk to you soon.
This was so fun. Thanks for having me. Cheers.
Cheers. That's the show. Check out ctopod.com. Stay connected. We love hearing from CTOs. We love hearing from CEOs. Anybody who needs to get their CTO plugged in, check out 7ctos.com. There are membership levels for everybody, so it's never too late to expand your network, nurture your relationships, and please, let's see each other soon, like next week. Cheers.